whole Balkans is gathering together here to fight for equality everywhere.
America the Beautiful, widely considered the other national anthem. Coming up on the Rainbow Minute.
We were set up in a time when material wasn't being collected, wasn't being preserved, and wasn't accessible. So we have the capacity now to showcase material that wasn't being collected by mainstream institutions, and it's also under community control.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Lucia Chappell. U.S. top court to consider LGBTQ job rights, gay Tunisian activist runs for president, and Aussie's archive Queer Life Chronicles. All that and more this week because you've chosen This Way Out.
I'm Wenzel Jones.
And I'm Laura Dickinson-Turner.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news interaffecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the week ending July 6th, 2019.
Circle October 8th on your 2019 LGBTQ plus dates to watch out for calendar. That's when the U.S. Supreme Court will start its process to finally determine whether federal law protects sexual and gender minorities from employment discrimination. The specific question before the High Court is whether or not Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 extends to sexual orientation and gender identity or expression. It's the law that bans workplace bias based on sex. Lower courts have diverged on the issue in specific cases involving anti-gay and anti-trans discrimination. A majority of judges have decided that Title VII does, indeed, protect LGBTQ people, but a few courts have not. So now, it's up to the High Court to decide. The justices' ruling in these cases is likely to affect how other federal anti-discrimination laws are interpreted. For example, the ban on sex-based bias in schools in Title IX of the Education Amendment of 1972 has been cited in cases involving transgender students. LGBTQ people and their families could also be covered by the Fair Housing Act by extension with this Supreme Court ruling. It's hardly a surprise that the Trump administration has filed briefs with the court in support of continued workplace discrimination. They're especially dedicated to defending it based on sincerely held religious belief or moral conviction.
Equality activists have become justifiably nervous since two Trump-nominated justices were added to the Supreme Court. Chief Justice John Roberts is now seen as the swing vote, even though he usually sides with a conservative 5-4 majority. In his story in the Washington Blade, reporter Chris Johnson quoted Roberts during the High Court discussion in 2014 that led to marriage equality. The Chief Justice said, "I mean, if Sue loves Joe and Tom loves Joe, Sue can marry him and Tom can't, and that difference is based upon their different sex. Why isn't that a straightforward question of sexual discrimination?" No matter how straightforward the question, Roberts eventually joined the conservative minority in the narrow 5-4 decision that opened civil marriage to same-gender couples in all 50 U.S. states. A few prominent Republicans have filed friend-of-the-court briefs in support of workplace protections for LGBTQ people. Dozens and dozens of Democrats have done the same. More than 200 major companies have filed supportive briefs. They include Disney, Ben & Jerry's, Coca-Cola, Domino's Pizza, IBM, Microsoft, Nike, Starbucks, Viacom, and Xerox. Major League Baseball's San Francisco Giants and Tampa Bay Rays also joined the signatories in the Supreme Court brief in support of workplace protections for LGBTQ people.
LGBTQ people in the U.S. might toast Mayor Pete Buttigieg as an historic first queer candidate among the almost two dozen Democrats seeking the presidency, but now Tunisia has a gay presidential candidate too. Lawyer and activist Munir Batur threw his hat into the ring with a June 25th social media posting. Batur is not only the North African nation's first out contender for the presidency, he's the first out candidate in the Arab world. Batur's Facebook announcement proclaimed, "Tunisia needs a democratic program that can include the different identities, cultures, beliefs, and languages of this country. After many years in the fight for minority rights, I have understood that no one can do the job better than me." Article 230 in Tunisia's century-old penal code sends adults convicted of engaging in consensual, same-gender sex to prison for up to 3 years. Batur has led the country's major LGBTQ advocacy group, SHAMS, to push for repeal of those laws. Several courts have rebuffed efforts by the government over the years to shut down the group, whose name means sun in Arabic. The Tunisian presidential election will be held in November of this year. Most observers don't give Batur any serious chance of unseating the incumbent in a field of other high-profile contenders, but nevertheless, his candidacy is as groundbreaking as Mayor Pete's.
The government of Poland is threatening legal action against global furniture retailer IKEA for firing a worker who had posted anti-queer remarks on the company's internal website. Justice Minister Zbigniew Ziobro has called for a probe into what he calls an unacceptable and absolutely scandalous action if it's proven to be true. He told the country's public television channel that the incident shows how foreign companies in Poland discriminate against those who don't share their values. Identified only as Tomasz K., the worker's comments were in reaction to a company statement on the internal site in support of the International Day Against Homophobia, Biphobia, and Transphobia. Tomasz K. quoted the Old Testament's condemnation of same-gender love in graphic terms and complained in his posting that, "I've been hired to sell furniture, but I'm a Catholic and these aren't my values." He was fired after he refused to take down the offensive comments. A statement issued by the Sweden-based multinational pointed out that the employee citations of the Old Testament warned of death and blood in the context of what fate should meet homosexual people. "Many employees contacted our human resources department. The basis of our corporate culture is freedom of opinion, but also tolerance and respect for each employee." Other Polish government officials are calling for a nationwide boycott of the furniture chain. According to Bloomberg News, IKEA has more than a dozen factories in Poland, making some 4,000 products that are sold globally. IKEA has close to the same number of retail outlets in the country.
There are new developments in last month's story about a Chicago-based tour operator facing opposition for planning excursions to Ethiopia with his mostly queer clientele. Toto Tours owner Dan Ware told NBC News that he's decided to cancel the tour. Ware had received email threats that he said were not something to ignore. One warned that you cannot come here, you are not even human. Others called it sex tourism, trying to pervert youth. Ware said another message included an ISIS-style video with a sword-brandishing masked man saying, "We are going to cut your throats." The 16-day itinerary would have included visits to some of Ethiopia's most revered religious sites, which is apparently what had ignited the threatening opposition. Ware said Toto Tours still has tours planned to other countries where gay sex is illegal, including Botswana, Bhutan, and Egypt. But he thought it would be prudent to cancel the planned October Ethiopia visit and to refund customers who'd already booked passage. Toto Tours have served a primarily queer clientele since 1990. By the way, the company website says that its name comes from the Latin word meaning all-inclusive. No, it's not an homage to Dorothy's famous dog in The Wizard of Oz.
World Pride was officially celebrated on the 50th anniversary of the Stonewall Rebellion, where it all began, New York City. The festivities were capped off by a huge parade on June 30th. Mayor Bill de Blasio said that as many as 5 million people gathered for the record-breaking parade. A more grassroots alternative march was also held to protest the corporatization of Pride and to return the annual observance to its political roots.
LGBTQ Pride celebrated for the first time in North Macedonia on June 29th. Several hundred people participated in the festivities in the capital city of Skopje, including cabinet members and foreign diplomats. People from Greece, Bulgaria, Serbia, and the UK also traveled to the Balkan city to lend support. North Macedonia's government is trying to improve minority rights as part of its effort to join the European Union. One local participant, identified only as Maria, expressed her enthusiasm in a Radio Free Europe report.
"We want to send a message that we are here, that we are going to fight for our rights no matter what, and that the whole Balkans is gathering together here to fight for equality everywhere."
But finally, another attempt to hold a pride march in Turkey was broken up by police using tear gas. Government officials had banned the event in Istanbul for the fifth consecutive year. According to news agencies, several hundred people rallied on the side streets off Istanbul's main pedestrian walkway. The demonstrators were waving rainbow flags and chanting, "Shoulder to shoulder against fascism," and "We will not be quiet." Then police moved in. They reportedly used rubber bullets and water cannons in addition to tear gas to disperse the crowd. The government's pride ban is apparently being defied by one of Turkey's largest breweries. A spokesperson for the popular beer Babonti announced online that the company was stocking bars nationwide with bottles sporting rainbow-colored labels. The government has yet to weigh in on whether or not the brewery is breaking any laws by marketing their beer this way. But queer social media lit up with celebratory support. "It's the first time I've seen a Turkish company embrace the rainbow," tweeted @BradleySecker. The poster admitted, yes, Pride has become more corporate, but in some cases it helps with visibility and has greater political and social oomph.
That's News Wrap, global queer news with attitude for the week ending July 6, 2019. Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap is written by Greg Gordon, edited by Lucia Chappell, produced by Brian DeShazer, recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles, and brought to you by you.
Help keep us in ears around the world at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast and much more.
And you can listen to News Wrap each week by subscribing to our This Way Out radio YouTube channel. For This Way Out, I'm Wenzel Jones.
And I'm Laura Dickinson Turner.
My eyes adore you.
Hello, I'm Alex Espinoza, author of the new book, Cruising, An Intimate History of a Radical Pastime, and you're listening to This Way Out, the worldwide weekly radio magazine for sexual and gender minorities and those who care about them.
Monty Python was a lesbian, and she was quite celebrated coming out in the 1980s at 102. She lived to 106. Between the 1920s and 1940s, she compiled two scrapbooks. These two scrapbooks document transgressive lives of the period.
Where are those scrapbooks now, you ask? Find out later in the program. But first... After lightning storms cleared the Capitol Mall during the Trump administration's vaunted July 4th Independence Day Salute to America celebration, here's a rainbow minute to rain on the president's patriotic parade a little more.
America the Beautiful, widely considered the other national anthem, coming up now on the Rainbow Minute. The lyrics were written by poet Catherine Lee Bates, a Wellesley College professor who lived for 25 years with her beloved Catherine Coman, a fellow professor there. Bates's poem was inspired by an 1893 trip to the top of Pikes Peak, where she marveled at the majestic view. Years later, Bates cared for Coman after breast cancer surgery. Upon Coman's death at 57, Bates expressed her grief by writing a collection of poems for the woman she had nicknamed Joy of Life. Titled Yellow Clovers, A Book of Remembrance, it took its name from the little flowers each had pressed into the letters they wrote to each other when apart. The Rainbow Minute is produced by Judd Proctor and Brian Burns and recorded in the studios at WRIR in Richmond, Virginia, and read by volunteers like me, Brenda Thornton.
Isn't life gay? Isn't life the perfect thing to pass the time away? So much cooler online.
There's nothing cooler than the world's only international LGBT radio magazine.
Unless it's thiswayout.org.
At thiswayout.org, you'll find program information,
related videos,
expanded features,
News Wrap transcripts,
and CDs and downloadable material.
It might not be cooler than radio,
but there's much more This Way Out at thiswayout.org.
Sweeties, bashful sweeties, I've got one of those. He's handsome as can be, but he worries me. Now this schoolboy is no fool boy, gee, what that boy knows. He's off in his Latin and Greek, but in his chic he's weak. Cause when I feel like love, and I've gotta have some love, he's so near yet so far, he's so unusual. When I want some kisses, and I'm burning up for kisses, he says, no, let me go. So unusual.
There's just one community-based organization in Australia dedicated to preserving the history of the LGBTQ+ movement, This Way Out Sydney correspondent Barry McKay caught up with one of the group's leaders at this year's Mardi Gras Fair Day.
I'm speaking with Nick Henderson of the Lesbian and Gay Archives in Melbourne. Can you tell me first, why a Gay and Lesbian Archives?
Sure. Look, the collection is broader than gay and lesbian. It's lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, intersex, brother boy, sister girl material. The reason why we have that material is we were set up at a time when most of that material wasn't being collected by institutional archives. And so for many of the states that we were collecting from, it was also illegal. There was still criminalisation. So we were set up at a time when material wasn't being collected, wasn't being preserved, and wasn't accessible. So we have the capacity now to showcase material that wasn't being collected by mainstream institutions, and it's also under community control. So one of the important things for us is that the community has access and has the ability to inform what we do. So we're very much embedded in the communities that we represent.
And you're based in Melbourne. Why not in Sydney, where there's much more of a LGBT scene?
Sure. Look, I probably disagree with that statement. I don't think there is much more of it, and I think that's certainly shifted over time. But what I would say is we were formed in 1978 in Sydney. We were an initiative of the 4th National Homosexual Conference. That conference at the time spoke for the movement. It was seen as representing the movement. And so it made a number of motions or resolutions, one of which was the establishment of the archives. The bulk of the activists who were involved in that meeting and in the motions were from Melbourne, and so that's where the organisation was physically located. There is a lot of different organisations that are based in different locations but represent Australia nationally, and in fact I would say most of those are probably in Canberra. From our perspective, we do work around Australia. While the collection might be physically located in Melbourne, we do a lot of work in different places, and so we have the capacity to both collect and preserve from across Australia, but also that material ideally, particularly in the case of print material, should be in multiple locations, not just with us.
So are you implying that the LGBT scene movement is actually moving from Sydney to Melbourne?
I think in different respects, and partly yes, but why I would say that there's a couple of different reasons for that, and certainly one of the contexts around the nightlife and a lot of the different venues and activities, there has been more active community in Melbourne. There hasn't been the issues associated with the lockout laws within a number of the key areas that were, I guess, the centres for queer culture and queer community. And that is absolutely not to say that there is not amazing thing happening in a lot of places. But there is a more supportive government at state government level and at multiple local government levels. So there is a lot of support and engagement and a lot of things happening. And you know, this isn't competitive. You know, there is a long-running, competition to an extent between the two cities. But, you know, we work well with both, and we support the work of organisations here as we do in all places in Australia.
Back to the archives.
Sure.
How many people are involved with the Australian Lesbian and Gay Archives?
Sure. We have a committee. So we're all volunteer-run. We have a committee of eight at the moment. We have active volunteers that probably sit around 30 to 40 on a week-to-week basis. That includes both on-site volunteers, off-site volunteers, online volunteers. And we also have volunteers who work just for specific projects.
What do you collect?
Sure. We collect... one of the things about community archives are that they're very diverse. They're not like an institutional archive in the sense of only representing organisational records. We have objects, we have banners, t-shirts, textiles, oral histories, audio-visual. We have dildo moulds to leather jackets. We have the water from the sauna at Ken's Karate Club, through to, you know, condom packs from the early 80s. So we have an incredibly diverse collection of format type material.
What's the oldest thing you have?
The oldest item in the collection is an 1847 British government report. So the report refers to, it's a reproduction of a letter that was written by the then Bishop of Tasmania, Nixon, to Lord Earl Grey. The letter really talks about transportation issues and issues amongst convicts in Tasmania, but also in Norfolk Island. And within the segment on Norfolk Island, it talks about between 100 and 150 same-sex couples living in marriage-like arrangements. So for us, you know, there's not a lot of documentation from the colonial period. Much of that rests within government archives, and it really looks at those points where at the time the men and women who were it's hard, you can't really use the word gay or lesbian or even really camp in that context, but you can say taking homosexual acts, were coming into contact with the law. So most of the documentation comes around that. So a lot of that sits with government archives, but thankfully we have some things like the British government report.
And you've also got something called the Monty Punch and Scrapbook. Can you tell me about that?
Sure. It's two objects. We have two scrapbooks. So Monty Punchin was a lesbian, and she, I guess, was quite celebrated coming out in the 1980s at 102. She lived to 106. Between the 1920s and 1940s, she compiled two scrapbooks and maybe others. But these two scrapbooks, I guess, document transgressive lives of the period. So it's the documentation is essentially newspapers and magazines, but those documents. So it's often butch women or passing women. So those aren't necessarily about, you know, that personal representation of her life, but it is through the documentation that she was able to collect at that time.
Hi, I'm Barry Mackay, and I'm speaking to Nick Henderson of the Australian Lesbian and Gay Archives at the 2019 Sydney Gay and Lesbian Mardi Gras Fair Day. Do you have any community outreach programs or exhibitions that travel?
Sure, we do. We've had a number. Currently, we partnered and worked on one called Serving in Silence, LGBTI Service Personnel After World War II. We've had another one, so that one's about to go to Newcastle in New South Wales. Another one that we did was looking at LGBTI law reform in Victoria. And that toured suburban Melbourne and regional Victoria. Another one that went with the LGBTI roadshow around regional Victoria. We've also lent images and objects to other exhibitions. So one current online exhibition, which focuses on HIV/AIDS volunteering in Sydney. So a lot of the bulk of that digital content for the image-based material comes from the archives.
So have you got quite a lot of stuff online that listeners overseas could look at?
Yeah, look, we do. It's not a vast quantity of visual material. Most of the information is about our holdings. We do have a test database which has a lot of images. For example, our t-shirt collection, all of the images of that is up. So we have about 750 t-shirts. A lot of our visual material we make available through social media. So we have a Facebook page and group, and so they provide an avenue to push out a lot of content, which we also do through Twitter and through other social media outlets.
What's your address on the net that people can look you up?
Sure. Our address is www.alga.org.au. So that's Australian Lesbian and Gay Archives. On Facebook, we are ALGA and then Archives without the R. So it just runs on.
Okay.
Yeah.
Do you collect stuff from overseas as well, or just Australian material?
We do collect international material, but it needs to have a link back to Australia. So, for example, during the 1970s, most Australian activists were getting their information from non-Australian sources. So we have a huge collection of international gay and queer periodicals or serials. We also have a lot of international HIV/AIDS education posters and badges as well. So it really, there needs to be a link there. So with a lot of activists, if their collection encompasses non-Australian material, so for example, we have a lot of stuff from Britain, or we have a lot of stuff relating to, say, the first gay pride march at Christopher Street West in LA. We have photographs and negatives relating to the early gay liberation movement in California. So that came in from an Australian activist. He lived in Australia for 40 years. So there's material from a lot of different places.
Do you liaise, or do you have relationships with other lesbian and gay archives overseas?
We do. I guess in the contemporary environment, a lot of those relationships are perhaps not as close as they were during periods when you were writing letters, but we still maintain contact, in particular with the Canadian Lesbian and Gay Archives, now Archives or Archives, but spelt with a Q, and the Lesbian Herstory Archives in New York. But we do have connections with one archives in LA, and also Bishopsgate, which is the London. Location in London. Yeah.
What sort of projects have you got coming up now?
Sure, we've got a couple of major projects. So one of those is a large-scale digitization project with Gail Cengage, which is looking at digitizing 200,000 pages from our periodical collection. So that'll be part of Gail's Archives of Sexuality and Gender product. So we'll be part of the fourth part of that product, which will come out next year. Our other major project is relocating into the Victorian Pride Centre and establishing a museum. So the museum will be a permanent space to showcase Australia's very queer history, which we're very excited by.
So as far as I recall, there's only two gay museums in the world, or LGBT museums in the world. One's in San Francisco, one's in Berlin. Would that be correct?
Well, it depends on how you class museum. There's also one in Brazil. So one, I'm not sure, I think it's in Sao Paulo. There's also the Leslie Lohman Gay and Lesbian Art Museum in New York. There is other collections where there's a permeable barrier between what you define as a museum. In Florida, there is also a collection, the Stonewall National Archives and Museum, I think they call it. So they have a permanent exhibition space. I think it rotates through. So there's many different institutions. There's also specifically a lesbian museum, which is in New Zealand. So there's a lot of different spaces, as well as archives that have permanent exhibitions. So one archives at University of Southern California, that has permanent exhibition spaces, but they're not a permanent ongoing exhibition in the same way. So a lot of those boundaries between what is a gallery, a library, an archive, a museum break down somewhat.
How can people contact the archives?
Sure, they can contact us either through our email, which is mail, M-A-I-L, at alga.org.au, or through our Facebook page or Facebook group. And, you know, we'll be on the other end responding fairly quickly.
Is it an open Facebook page or is it a closed Facebook page?
It's an open Facebook page, and we also have an associated Facebook group, which is, it is a closed group in that you just have to join to become a member. And as many people who are involved in social media know, there is a lot of fake profiles out there. But we, it's a, you know, our Facebook page has about 7,500 people. Our group has about 3,500 people. And there's a lot of opportunity to engage in that kind of space as well.
Anything else you'd like to add?
Oh, look, I think just save your own, you know, if you're involved in queer life, you know, your life is important and valuable. You should be preserving your material and, you know, get involved in your local queer archive, wherever that may be, and help preserve, celebrate and cherish your queer history.
Nick Henderson, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Barry.
This is Barry Mackay in Sydney, Australia, for This Way Out.
The Australian Lesbian and Gay Archives will hold its 19th annual Australia's Homosexual Histories Conference in November at Australian National University in Canberra. Thanks for choosing This Way Out, brought to you by the nonprofit Overnight Productions. Some program material this week came from Wenzel Jones and Laura Dickinson Turner, produced by Brian DeShazer, from Brenda Thornton, produced by Jed Proctor and Brian Burns, and from Barry Mackay. Barry Manilow, Mason Williams, Brad Paisley, and Des Tooley performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, the Ivana Foundation, the estate of Christopher David Trentum, Christopher Matthews, Richard Merck and Brad Payton of Silicon Valley, and all of the listener donors who make this program possible. Look for This Way Out Radio on social media, email tworadio@aol.com, or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For coordinating producer Greg Gordon and all of us at This Way Out, I'm Lucia Chappelle. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org and on CJMP Powell River, British Columbia, WUML Haverhill, Massachusetts, KDUR Durango, Colorado, and some 200 stations and other outlets around the world, including this one. Now y'all stay tuned.